Hello.
Hi, welcome to the show. How about you guys introduce yourself?
Sure. My name's Cameron Petty. I am the team lead at Jump Corps, working on Undead Overlord.
My name's Martin, and I'm also working on Undead Overlord with Cameron, and I'm a programmer on the team.
Okay, and what's Undead Overlord about?
Undead Overlord is a zombie game from the inside out. We wanted to try and do something different in the zombie space and turn things around. So the idea is that you're controlling a zombie horde and hunting humans and trying to take over the world. It starts off in a pre-apocalyptic situation, and the first few maps are kind of just creating chaos and moves through and eventually winds up in a post-apocalyptic world where the humans are smarter and they're survivors and dug in and a bit more of a challenge.
And for the audience out there, what's the website that has more information about the game so they can check it out while they're listening?
It's undeadoverlord.com.
Okay. And how do you spell that, just in case?
Sure, UNDEAD OVERLORD.com.
Great. And also for the audience out there, this interview was inspired by my recent post about looking for developers using Unity. So later on in the interview, we'll probably talk a little about Unity and some of the benefits there. So what inspired you to make this game? Why this game over another game, and what platform did you choose to develop it for? I know you're using Unity, but maybe you had a specific platform in mind.
Well, it's interesting. It's been a long journey with this game. We've been working on it for years now. The current incarnation with Unity for just over 1 year, but there were a couple incarnations before that. The game was originally designed as an MMO where you could play as either humans or zombies, and this is way back before Unity was really around. I think Unity was around, but was just getting started, and it was before the kind of the free game engine revolution. I'm not sure what to call it. It's before there were versions of game engines that were free to use for indie teams. The only one that was out there was the Source SDK. There was no free version of the Unreal Engine. Unity was just getting started, so we actually did a demo on the Source Engine that was a first-person shooter kind of thing, because, well, basically because that's what the Source SDK is good at doing. And didn't get a whole lot of traction with that. And then, just the games industry has been doing backflips in terms of business models and engine availability, and indie teams really seeing some good success. So seeing all that going on, we eventually decided, well, let's try and do something on our own. Let's switch over to the Unity engine, which is much more flexible in terms of the types of games you can build on it, and kind of launched off down that road, and that's the road we've been going on, and it's great. We love the Unity engine and really have been having fun working with it.
Yeah, I think for the audience out there, I mean, it is, I was just thinking about this recently. I mean, it's kind of hard to imagine, but you're right. Maybe even 3 or 4 years ago, having an indie developers or indie, a small indie studio having access to kind of deeper tools like this without spending a lot of money, wasn't really well known. I mean, I guess there was the Torque engine, but I don't
Right,
think it's
right.
as sophisticated as Unity is right now.
Not anywhere close, and there was like Ogre 3D, I guess, if you really wanted to kind
Yeah.
of get
Well,
your, roll up your sleeves and get your hands dirty. But yeah, it's been a huge change.
and you were talking about just even changes in business models. The question is when you first started out, it sounded like you guys were targeting the PC. And are you folks still targeting the PC, or are you going to go for mobile? Because when you think about indie success, you think really about mobile, at
Well, it's
least recently,
interesting. I
Yeah.
think there's a lot of a lot of action on the indie front on the PC these days through,
Sure.
you know, Steam and
Yeah,
Steam
Steam, yeah.
Greenlight and you know, honestly, we're planning on doing both. That's one of the great things about Unity also is that it's very multi-platform. And right now we are able to run the game both on iPads and on desktops.
And are you going to have, well, is there going to be a preference? I mean, is there going to be one platform that's going to be your primary platform, or how are you going to do that?
Well, we're shooting for initial release for the iPad at the moment.
Okay.
For many reasons, not least of which is being able to test more widely. We're keeping the desktop version, you know, up to date, and functional, to the same degree that the mobile version is.
And when do you expect, when is the release date planned for?
Well, that's a really good question. That's going to depend on a few things. Obviously, we'd like to get it out there as soon as possible. At the moment, we've been doing a lot of prep for putting together a Kickstarter, and we're going to try and raise some funds to bring a few more of the team members on full time so that we can speed up this development and get it out there sooner rather than later.
And I mean, do you feel it's going to get done by the end of the year, or do you feel it's going to go on to next year, or?
I think probably realistically, we're looking at next spring.
Okay. And for mobile, you read about some of these indie successes, like I don't know if you heard of Clash of Clans or some of these other
Of course.
companies. And do you feel that you have to get everything perfect, or is it just better to get it out there and just get feedback and just get potentially revenue from players or something else like that, and then growing it that way? Or do you feel it needs to be perfect? I mean, there are benefits to both.
Yeah, that's also a very good question. I'm not sure I have a good answer for you there. I mean,
Because I mean, you're talking about, like, you hear Clash of Clans making like millions every day. I mean, that's first of all, that's pretty inspiring for an indie developer. I mean, yeah, I know they're bigger now, and yeah, but they still have like less than 100 people, you know, and I think the Clash of Clans team has like 30 or 40, or it's probably grown, but I mean, that's pretty amazing that kind of an unknown studio can come in and do that.
It is pretty amazing. I guess my feeling on that is that, you know, the games industry to some degree has always been hit driven.
Yeah, that's true.
And there's always a few people who have those sorts of, you know, massive successes, but it's certainly not something that happens to most indie teams or
Well, I don't
even
know.
many indie teams.
When I think about this mobile thing, I mean, I heard about this studio that they did Zombie Farm. You know, you're talking about zombies, right?
Sure.
And I don't, have you heard of Zombie Farm? I think it's called Zombie Farm or something like that. But they were on Apple. They were on iPhone,
Okay.
like 2 or 3 years ago, and they were like a husband and wife team. You know, they obviously grew it a little, you know, as they gained success, but they made over 10 million.
Yeah, there's always those
So I don't know if it's the
another
exception
one like
though.
that, right?
Oh, what? Go ahead.
Temple Run is another
Oh
story like that, right?
yeah.
Tiny team and massive success. You go back a little farther, and you know there are other stories like
Yeah,
that.
you're right.
Id was the original, right? Where
Yeah.
Doom
And even
was this
Sierra.
shareware, and yeah.
But I think what's
So,
interesting about your game. Oh, go ahead. What were you going to say?
no, that's all right. Go ahead.
Oh, what I was going to say is your game's an MMO, and I think part of the success of MMOs, at least, you know,
Well,
because I watch some of
let
these.
me qualify.
Sure.
I may have
Oh,
misled
my fault.
you
It
and
was
other people.
initially.
The original design way back when was an MMO, and
Okay.
we actually went and tried to, you know, this was, we were going the more traditional game route, and trying to raise some funds from or do a deal with a publisher, and it was a tough time for MMOs at that time. What was it? The guys who did who were originally doing Star Trek Online,
Oh yeah. Is that
they had gone under. Flagship had gone under, and nobody was too interested in starting MMOs. I don't know. It's a long story. I'll tell you what, one thing I wanted to mention was that I actually did a blog post in great detail telling the story of how this game kind of evolved from, you know, an MMO design initially to what it is now, which is a real-time strategy game. We call it a Zombie Dominion RTS to kind of differentiate it from the standard zombie survival games that you see a lot of out there these days. If any of the listeners are interested in that, that's posted at catchgames.com, which is my blog. And obviously, I can't go into that much detail here today. Probably it's a long story, but it's all up there if people are interested in finding out more.
Okay, but it's going to be multiplayer, right?
The initial release is going to be single player.
Okay.
We would love to do multiplayer, and so I guess that gets back to your question about, you know, do you get it out there early or do you make it perfect? And so there you have your answers. We want to get it out there sooner rather than later, rather than make it perfect. So much as we would love to have it be multiplayer and have you be able to play the human side of things as well, our focus is to get something out there, get feedback on it. And let people play the zombie side of things, single player, sooner, as soon as possible.
And how is the, as you've transitioned, how has the team responded to all this? Because it seems very different than what was the initial motivation.
Yeah.
And there's some benefits to that, because you're right. I mean, I see at the polish when I was checking out your website, and it's amazing, you know, for a small studio.
And, oh, thanks.
And so the question is, you know, how does the team respond to changes as you need to change them to, you know, work with the market, work with timelines and stuff like that?
Well, I consider myself extremely lucky that I actually still have a team working with me, given that we have made some drastic changes to the game and it's taken a lot longer to, you know, get as close to a release as we've gotten now. I'm not sure I can explain that really. I guess it's indicative of you know, some strong belief in the project and just kind of a team that is willing to stick together and tough it out.
And were there any game design issues that you ran into while you're designing the current iteration of the game?
Oh yes, lots of game design issues. I mean, I that's always the case with games in general. I think it's that they're an iterative process, right? And you learn as you go along. But in this case, I think one of the most interesting things about the design, and one of the things we've been kind of hyping is it makes it cool, but it also is challenging. Is that what we've been saying is your enemy is your resource. So rather than, you know, as a zombie controller, rather than destroying the human units that you attack, you actually, you know, engulf them into your horde. And it makes balance really kind of interesting. And in all honesty, it's something that we're still experimenting with. And tuning is going to be a challenge.
Yeah. Can you talk about how you tune in RTS? You know, how do you... Yeah, I mean, what's your process for balancing these games?
Play it a lot, get people to test it, watch how they do, and iterate over and over and over and over and over.
Okay, so basically any change you make in the balance, you have to retest everything then.
I mean, we do a lot of going through and testing the maps, and it's going to be It's an interesting process, and again, I'll go back to, you know, we love Unity. Unity is awesome, and one of the cool things about working with Unity is that, you know, you can change things quickly and see the results of your tuning, you know, right there in the editor, and try things out really easily, which is fantastic.
When you're playing and you're retesting the game as you make these changes, I mean, do you like intuitively or have a gut feel of, okay, this is off or this is working, or when can you sense, or do you feel that, or does your intuition work in sensing that, okay, this is the right balance, or do you literally need a ton of other people to also give you that feedback too?
I think the latter. I mean, I think you start off with your intuition, right? You get something in there that feels right, that seems intuitively correct, and then you go out and, you know, turn it loose on people, and sometimes it turns out you're right, oftentimes it turns out not so much.
And what's been, would you say, the biggest surprise or change you've had to make based on testing?
Oh, that's, you know, I don't know that I would cite one big one, but more like a lot of little ones where it's just like, because we're so close to it, because we're used to the theme and we understand what the intention is of the game, a lot of times stuff that seems really obvious to us just won't be obvious to other people. A good example from some recent testing that Martin and the guys, well, just a quick note, we're a distributed team, so we're mostly in the SF Bay Area, but we have a decent chunk of the team out in the DC area as well, and they were at IndieCon DC recently and got a bunch of good feedback and playtesting there. And one of the interesting ones that I thought was amusing and I never would have guessed was at the beginning of one of the levels, there's this tiny little alleyway between two buildings that I never would have thought that someone would think was part of the map, really, because it's only about a foot wide, maybe. But apparently people would be persistently trying to go down there and frustrated that they could not. So it's just stuff like that. It's a lot of little things where you're like, oh, really? Okay. Well, I guess something should block off that alleyway, you know?
Yeah. And that was kind of an especially interesting one. I'm going to jump in real quick.
Yeah, jump in.
Because I was there. Yeah. But, you know, we've all been looking at these levels for so long, right, in different forms. But as soon as we show this to a group of people who aren't as familiar with them, and they all do exactly the same thing that none of us do, then that's a pretty good indicator that we are way too close to this thing and have lost a lot of our ability to actually just do this, you know, without showing getting new
right.
people involved
to see it objectively. Yeah.
And what's been the response? Any other responses that testers have been giving you for your game?
So the latest demo that we did that Cameron was just talking about, it was IndieCon DC, which was a small sort of get together in the DC area, and you know, we had a lot of really positive kind of feedback. So that was the main thing that helps keeps us going, which is, you know, people love the idea. You know, we say, you know, you are the zombie horde, you are, you know, taking over humans one at a time, and people love it. So I think that's been the main takeaway, and the rest is just kind of tuning and building out some of these levels,
polish,
and getting it right.
And how many hours of gameplay are you aiming for in your initial release? I mean, is there a set number of levels or hours you're shooting for?
That's a good question. No, we don't really have a set number of hours that we're shooting for per se. We're currently we have 10 missions designed out, and then would like to have an 11th, maybe a 12th, where it's the first 10 are kind of, we almost look at those as an extended tutorial where it kind of works you through, you know, all of the different unit types that you can have and the different strategies that you can use. And then the final couple missions will be more kind of open-ended, control point-based situations where hopefully there will be a fair amount of more replayability value where, you know, each time it's a little bit different depending on how you approach the level.
Okay. And by the way, I just remembered something about that Zombie Farm game. It was actually single-player at first. Then they eventually moved it over to multiplayer.
So I just wanted to
mention that. yeah, and they were fairly successful. They actually had an interesting talk, one of them, at Casual Connect, which is, I don't know if you've been to Casual Connect, the conference, but...
I was there, yeah.
Okay, yeah, it's online, but what's interesting is that they would continuously do updates throughout the year, and then actually at the end of the year, they ended up with more daily users than they had initially, which normally, when you think about the normal trend of games, you know, they usually spike in terms of downloads and then go down over time.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, we're seeing more and more that games are being approached his games as a service, right?
Yeah.
Where it's not a single release and then you're done with it. And you know, it makes me think of you know, Valve has to some degree pioneered that with Team Fortress 2, right? Where it's just constantly evolving. They're constantly doing these little updates and keeping people interested.
And do you have a roadmap for that? Is that something that you're thinking about now, or you're going to think about that maybe later when you're about to release?
Well, I mean, we've definitely thought about that in terms of we certainly want to keep working on the thing after the initial release. And we have that mindset for sure. And you know, like we said earlier, multiplayer is something that we would really love to do. And so that'll be on the horizon. So, yeah, I see. I definitely think of it in those terms these days. Of you know, the initial release is a starting point rather than an end point.
And let's talk about windows of opportunity. You know, part of the success of some of these games is not only being on the right platform, but also being there at the right time. And what do you feel about the opportunities of, say, iPad next year versus now and then even Steam?
That's a good question. I guess, you know, our thought is, again, we love Unity, the fact that it's pretty easy to port things from platform to platform. So, I mean, we're initially targeting iPad. There's a fairly good user base out there for those. We like the desktop and particularly PC market because there's a strong, you know, indie kind of culture developing there. But, you know, now we're looking at things like or seeing things develop now, like, you know, Xbox One. They just announced, you know, indies will be able to self-publish on there, which is pretty cool news. I don't know, you know, where we'll be in terms of our game and availability on that platform, but it certainly, you know, kind of makes your eyes light up a little bit, like, oh, cool, a new potential place that we could have an outlet for the game. That's great, you know.
And have you played any RTS games on iPad so far?
I mean,
I don't know of any that I've seen.
There are a few out there. I tried one. Honestly, I was not impressed with it just because it was pretty much a StarCraft clone and really had taken the PC interface and just kind of plopped it onto the iPad. Which I don't think worked all that well. The actual space you could see the game in was really kind of tiny, and most of the screen was taken up by interface. So that's one of the things that you know, we've been really interested in, and it's kind of another challenge, but also the fun of designing an RTS for the iPad, which is, well, how can we do the interface differently so that it's suited to the touchscreen, you know? So how can we kind of minimize the on-screen interface and kind of try and get at something that's intuitive? And, you know, I'm going to be honest with you, I don't think we're there yet, but it's part of the challenge and part of the fun and part of that iterative process of, you know, testing with people. It's like, well, what do they understand about this touch specific interface that we're designing, and what don't they, and how can we improve that?
Okay, and let's talk about go ahead.
No, I don't. did that answer your question, Martin? What about you? Have you what's your experience with RTSs on tablets?
Yeah, I think I have had a pretty similar experience. I think that's probably the game that I pointed you towards, was that StarCraft clone, which was cool, but doesn't really unlock some of what I think of as like the potential of a tablet interface for a strategy game. I think, you know, the design, you know, implications of building a game for iPad are a little bit different, but they're also really interesting for strategy games, because you've got this immediacy with a touch interface, right? You've got a portability, meaning you can play anywhere, which is cool by itself, but you've also got a totally different way to interact with the screen. So I think that is going to work out really well for a strategy game like the one we're building, if we can execute it well. And as Cameron said, you know, we're working out a few kinks, but it's definitely clear that it's going to be a really cool game to play on the iPad versus differently on the PC.
That's what I was going to say, is I haven't really seen any huge RTSs yet on iPad, and that could be the opportunity, you know,
right.
Is that no one has really done it right. Now, with the touch interface, because you have that, can you interact then with individual characters or have mini games inside this RTS, or is that even something you're considering, or is that just going to mess up the whole flow of the RTS?
Well, you definitely interact with individual characters, right? So, and, you know, it works similarly to a PC in which you're directing, you know, either groups of units or individual units. So that will work quite similarly, except that you can look at a unit and physically touch it, and that just, you know, you're closer into the gameplay, I think.
Okay, so it's not going to be, because one thing I've seen done on iPads with MMOs is not only do they have the MMO aspect, but they also have literally, like, you know, physics-based mini games that are popular with the touch interface. They aren't necessarily tied into the actual MMO. I mean, you're doing the mini games just for entertainment, and they have some not really like a tight integration with the MMO itself. So I wasn't sure if that's something you guys are looking into, or if it's just going to be pure RTS.
It's going to be, I think, more pure RTS, but there's going to be, you know, lots of, we want to create a more immersive environment than you see in a lot of RTSs, right? So we have things like a lot of destructible objects. So you can go in there and you can, you know, blow up a fire hydrant and have water, you know, sprayer everywhere. You can go, you know, attack a porta potty. So there's lots of interesting things that you can go right into do with the environment that doesn't necessarily have a huge direct gameplay impact, but are fun to do as a zombie horde. So we're trying to create that, you know, experience of being the zombie horde, and what would zombies want to do if they're just unleashed on this town.
And have you folks decided on the monetization model? Are you going to do in-app purchases? Are you going to have a paid app? Or
we have a plan on that, but I'm going to hold off on detailing that for the time being, just because it's really it's kind of the Wild West out there these days in terms of what people are doing. So we're kind of keeping our cards close to our chest in that respect, because we want to really kind of, I don't know. Well, there are a lot of possibilities. At the moment, we're leaning towards a free-to-play model, but there's a lot of bad blood out there with regards to that, because some people have just done that in kind of an unfortunate way, especially in some of the Asian markets that, you know, works in terms of sucking a lot of money out of people, and particularly, you know, the quote unquote whales. But we don't want, you know, our greatest hope is to establish a community of players around this game that stay with it and enjoy it and continue to enjoy it as we update it and work on it. So the last thing we want to do is, you know, alienate our users by adopting an evil monetization model. So that's really that's a big question in our minds right now, and something that we're closely watching what other people are doing and trying to figure out. You know, is there a way to, you know, have something where we can easily get, you know, the nice thing about free to play is you can get it into people's hands easily, right?
Yeah.
And get it out there and into a lot of people's hands, and that's great. But so, is there a way that we can do that but still have it be fair? We think there is. We think we've come up with something that makes sense, but it's still something that we're kind of running by people and watching how other people do it. And like I said, it's a bit of the Wild West out there, so we're not quite ready to do that reveal just yet.
And to be fair, some of the companies in Asia, I mean, they are making, a ton of profit.
Oh, they're making huge sums of money.
And I don't know if the players feel they're getting exploited, because they just keep spending more and more. I mean, you think about DNA, and I don't know if you heard about that new company new game called Puzzle Dragons or something like that, or Puzzles and Dragons.
Yeah, Puzzle and Dragon, Gung Ho, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think players care. Like, I mean, honestly, like, and I know you say, like, okay, how do you actually get the majority of the players to maybe contribute? I don't know if that even happens, like, because because I think you've hit the nail on the head. It is just like 1 or 5% that just funds everything.
I don't know either. It's very interesting to watch this stuff. And I think some games certainly are that way, where they're really just tuned to, you know, suck money out of 5% of their players.
I mean, is it really sucking money? Because I don't know if it's just people just skeptical, you know, because it's crazy to think that someone is spending $4,000 on a match three game.
Yeah.
But that happens.
For me personally, I look at that and that just screams addiction. You know, it's like that to me looks like someone who's going to Vegas and, you know, betting their nest egg.
and so the question is it worthwhile to have them spend it on Vegas or here? I mean, what's the lesser of two evils?
Well, there's always going to be people who are going to, you know, release games and let people spend as much money as they want and do that sort of thing, right? Yeah. I mean, that's kind of Zynga's whole business model, as far as I can tell. but I'm not sure we want to go there.
You know, that's a good point. Have you found a free-to-play company that you feel is ethical or inspires you to be like, you know what, we can learn from them? Because
we have. We've seen a couple games and what seems to be maybe coming out as an ethical free-to-play thing. See, you're forcing my hand here to talk more about this.
I think it's an awesome question because
– But it is a really good question.
Because on one hand, it's like, look, without the free-to-play model, game developers would be – a lot of them would be starving artists. And at the same time, you know, like you said, it, you know, when someone spends $5,000 on a match three game, you know, it's definitely something out of our realm of reality until we've already heard of it, right? Like, we wouldn't believe that was possible unless people were talking about it at the game developers conference or some of these other conferences. Right. And so,
well, you can look at that way, that sort of thing two ways, right?
Yeah.
One is that, well, that person is doing it because they enjoy doing it. And, you know, more power to them. Why should that be a problem? The other is that, well, that person is addicted and they can't help themselves and that's a problem. I tend to lean towards the latter rather than the former, but it's certainly an open question.
Well, I just feel like part of it was the AAA companies just couldn't fathom this business model. And because, you know, it was – literally, these indie companies were making more than these AAA, at least in terms of profit.
Yeah.
And I don't know if part of the concern or the hesitation was because, wait, they've got this new business model that seems crazy, but it's letting us up. But you're right. They're it's interesting to view it from the ethical point of view, which is like, look, what because this is a powerful business model, and at the same time, what is ethical?
Right. Well, and it depends on the game too, right? There are different ways to approach it from the game side. The thing that to me seems most evil is I've heard about these games. I think one example would be Mafia Wars, where basically it's a pay to win kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
And the more money you put in, the better you're going to do, and my understanding is that what they do is they start a server and they let people kind of clamor over each other to get to the top of the heap on that server to the point where no one is paying anymore because there are these people who have paid so much that there's no way you can compete with them.
Yeah.
And then they turn off that server and they fire up another server and let the basically land grab start over again.
Okay.
And it's massively profitable, but it's just, I don't know, I don't understand it as a game player. I would never get into that sort of thing. It's like I grew up, you know, with the mindset of, you know, I'm going to date myself here, but I grew up with the mindset of you put your one quarter into the arcade machine and you see how far you can get on it. Right, and you see how much you can get on as little as possible in terms of what you paid. So when I was little, that was what we were doing. So when I look at people, you know, paying tons of money just to be higher in the standings, that's completely alien to me as a player. As a game developer, you know, it's kind of this tempting, juicy target in terms of, you know, having a profitable company. But you know, one of the reasons I'm a game developer also is that I want to make cool games that I think I would want to play. So I'm a little alienated from that business model in that sense.
Okay. And
does that make sense? Am I making any sense here?
Kind of. I was going to ask you, what do you feel are, say, ethical principles for someone to design something that's free to play, but also fair? And also understanding of the fact that, you know what, 1-5% are only going to pay for your game.
Well, I think that, you know, I haven't been thinking about this a lot lately, and I guess my, you know, I don't want to declare what I think is ethical, but, you know, I guess
people are always.
I heard somebody say something very interesting in a comment on a blog post recently, and what they said was that, you know, free to play isn't actually free to play. What free to play is price obscured, right? Yeah. It means that going into the game, you don't know how much you're going to pay in order to get through the game, and that's part of what I was talking about in terms of it's the Wild West. It's every game, every company is kind of doing their own thing. You download the thing for free, sure, but you're not sure, you know, where you're going to have to start paying and how much you're going to have to start paying to actually see, you know, to play through the whole game. And people are doing a lot of different stuff on that front. I think maybe what would be helpful is if, you know, companies were a little more upfront. I mean, you can look at the free-to-play thing as being very similar to a free version and a paid version, right? Where you download the free version, but it's a limited amount of content, and then if you like it, you say, hey, all right, I'm going to go download the paid version and get all of it.
Yeah.
But in that case, it's much more clear what your cost is going to be. Whereas on the free-to-play side, you don't necessarily know going in how much you're going to pay. There was another game, one of the car racing games. I saw a thing saying, you know, in order to actually see all the content into this game, somebody had gone through and done it, right? And had figured out, like, what do I actually have to pay if I want to see every bit of content in this game? And it was something crazy, like, you know, $450, right? More than you would ever really consider paying for a game up front if you knew you were going to pay that, right? So that's why it seemed to me like the idea of these games being price obscured is really more realistic terminology, rather than free to play. It's free to try, and then who knows how much you're going to have to pay to get through it all. So my thought is that, you know, in order to make it ethical, in order to make it not evil, I don't know if that means it's ethical. It's,
sure.
It's maybe it would be better if people were a bit more upfront about, you know, sure, it's free to download, but this is how much you're going to have to pay to, you know, get through the rest of the game to see all the content that you might want to see if you like the game.
Okay. And let's move to marketing and monetization. So you know, you said you're going to release this game probably spring of next year. Why start this early in terms of marketing, and what are you doing for marketing to kind of gain that user base that will be attracted to your game and be excited about it right from day one when it gets released?
Well, like I said, we're for the most part we're doing this out of a love of making games. Most of the people on the team are you know, working for Sweat Equity, and we are going to launch a Kickstarter and try and raise some funds that way so that we can speed up development and bring people on board full time. This is, you know, a fairly common thing these days, right? It's not like we're unique in that respect. But what we realized was we got all our stuff for our Kickstarter. You know, we're close to being ready in terms of, you know, we got a video put together, we have some, you know, models ready to do 3D prints and T-shirts and yada yada and cool stuff. But we decided that, you know, if we launch a Kickstarter and nobody knows about us, that's going to be problematic. So to answer your question in terms of why we started telling people about the game this early, it's really to raise awareness for the Kickstarter.
When do you expect the Kickstarter to be out then?
As soon as possible. That also is a good question. And part of what we're trying to judge is, you know, at what point is the awareness that we've created for the game enough that enough people will see it, that maybe the Kickstarter will be successfully funded. And that also is, you know, I keep coming back to this analogy, but it's also a bit of a Wild West thing on the Kickstarter front, right? A lot of people doing it, a lot of different results.
Yeah, what inspired you to say do the Kickstarter now rather than last year? Because it seemed like Kickstarter was, you know, you heard about all these like huge deals with Kickstarter. So what are your thoughts on that?
I think that we just weren't in a position to be ready to do that.
Now you have more to show. I mean, that's one benefit.
Yeah, I you know, maybe we could have tried something last year. I'll be completely honest with you. I guess we just didn't think of it. Or if we thought of it, we were, you know, I guess my impression was that most of what was being successful in Kickstarter were either spiritual successors to popular games of the past, or Kickstarter's run by people who are big names in the industry, right? Your Tim Schafer, your Jordan Weissman. And, you know, much as I might like to be that, I'm not. and nor are we doing something that's a spiritual successor to a successful IP, right? We're doing something that's completely new and kind of a little bit, you know, unusual. So I guess part of it was we felt like we had to have a fair amount to show. We had to be able to show people what our vision was and be able to say, hey, we've gotten far enough along with this that we can tell that this is going to be fun and be able to communicate that to people.
And how does your team keep up with the games industry and just see kind of what's going on and maybe some of the new trends that are happening and stuff like that? I mean, is it mainly reading blogs or is it anything else? Or, okay.
I think, you know, reading blogs, following certain people on Twitter and keeping track of some of the more popular game portals. And I don't know, how do you keep track of the industry, Martin?
Yeah, all that stuff. Plus, you know, we're going to a couple of these conferences every now and then.
Yeah.
You know,
right, Casual Connect we mentioned.
And, you know, playing games and talking to people. So,
and where do you see the industry going? I mean, for smaller developers, where do you feel the opportunity is? And what's going to happen? I mean, do you feel that iPad and tablets as a platform are going to grow in the next year? Are they going to decline in the next year? Is it about Google Glass or what? Like,
that is a big question. I guess my experience, having been in the games industry for quite a while, is that the games industry thus far has been kind of following along with the development of the film industry in a lot of ways. If you look at the early days of the film industry, when, you know, the film production companies initially did everything, right? They were like the big publishers we've had in the last few decades, where they had everything in-house, but eventually kind of started to break up, and things got outsourced more and more. We've been seeing that happening in the games industry more recently, and now we're seeing this sort of stratification into almost two separate industries, where you have kind of the indie side of things and then you have the AAA side of things. That also kind of parallels the way the film industry grew up. And I think we're just seeing that really come into its own now. It's interesting in the games industry, something that's somewhat different is this whole idea of, you know, allowing indies to self-publish on you know, like on the consoles. I think that's something new. And I'm very interested to see, you know, how things continue to develop on that front. I guess my take is that, you know, the games industry always has new platforms coming along on a regular basis. And that's not going to change. Sure, maybe Google Glass will be something that has an effect on games, and obviously tablets are something new. But in the end, they are just additional outlets for people to play cool games on, and I think we'll continue to see that same sort of thing going forward.
Go ahead.
I don't know. I'm making this all up off the top of my head.
That's
obviously haven't been prepared on this front.
Well, I was going to also ask. Just, I mean, do you feel that the genres? You know, you talk about this kind of being like the early film industry. Do you feel that the genres of games have been solidified too? So it's really now about, you know, taking those already established genres and doing twists or variations on them.
To some degree, I think that's true, and that's always going to be the case with, you know, the AAA games and big publishers, because they're just so risk averse. But that's the beauty of the you know, the indie establishment, is that you know, that's where the cool weird ideas, that's where your Blair Witch projects and whatever come out of, where people are doing things that probably would not have gotten done by a larger company, because they're either too risky or they're just, you know, new and they don't fit into those established categories. So I think that's a beautiful thing, and I think that is going to be the, you know, the ecosystem going forward, where there's this, things percolate up from the indie scene, where there's a lot more experimentation going on. And if we're gonna have new genres, that's where they're gonna come from.
Yeah, and for let's talk about Unity. So you said you've been using Unity now for the past year.
Yeah.
And I guess what's been the biggest surprise surprises from Unity? Because I think they recently also changed their business model too a little, such that you could actually release a free version.
Right. Well, all they made the mobile versions free, right?
Yeah.
And they made it so that you can pay a monthly fee for the pro version.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, aside from that, have there been any other surprises, I guess, like just interacting with the Unity community, or just using Unity in general?
Surprises.
Like huge benefits, you know, things that have just blown your mind because it just changes the way development happens for you.
Well, I mean, the biggest thing for me, having worked with many engines over the years, is just the beauty of being able to run the game in the editor and make changes to the underlying data in real time and see that happen. That to me has been huge.
Okay.
Yeah, I would add to that just the flexibility of Unity itself. You know, that's the fact that you can go into Unity and build an FPS, you know, or an RTS, or a platformer, and all of these games, you know, and the engine's going to do a really well, you know, great job, as long as you can figure out what you're doing. That's pretty incredible, I think.
Okay. Yeah, the other thing that I think is really cool is the what do they call it, the store, the,
oh yeah, the Unity store.
Asset store.
Yeah, the asset store. The fact that, you know, that it's a plug-in based architecture, and people are doing, you know, amazing things that, you know, the folks at Unity may not even have thought of, right? That's pretty awesome.
Yeah. And for developers out there, what suggestions do you have for indie studios doing their own thing, or working with a remote team or anything like that?
Well, don't give up. I don't know if that's a suggestion. That's more like advice. But I mean, that's a big part of it. You know, the indie thing can get tough in terms of, you know, working in isolation, or not feeling like you have the resources that you need. So that's my takeaway. Don't give up.
I think something that's come along, you know, as a side effect of our beginning to actually show the game to people, you know, in preparation for our Kickstarter, which is why we began doing it. But a side effect of that has been that we've been able to get lots of good feedback. And that's created a really helpful, you know, feedback loop of, you know, keeping our team motivated and, you know, knowing what to work on next, and you know, moving our milestones forward with some, you know, a little bit of outside inspiration.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Okay, great. And once again, for the audience out there, where can they find out more information about your game?
Oh yeah, so we're making Undead Overlord, the zombie Dominion RTS. You can find us at undeadoverlord.com. You can also find us at facebook.com/undeadoverlord. And the company Twitter account is at JumpCore Pro. So JumpCorePro.
Okay, great. Thanks again for your time.
Sure. Thanks for having us.
Yep.
Thanks. Take care.